I'm excited to be with you this week, excited to kick off our journey in the Samaritan Traveler. What you are going to experience this week is a condensing of a four-week master's level course, so yay, into 4 days. And I taught this course in the winter of this past year, so in January of this past year, to a group of seminary students from about four different seminaries. And the goal of this class was really to explore the ways in which the historical, the social, and the theological have all come together to create what we know now are systems of oppression. And I have a bias in this, in that my bias is that I believe that most oppressive systems, whether they are homophobic, transphobic, misogynistic, patriarchal, have their root in part in white, anti-black racism. In many cases, they go hand in hand. Our ways of understanding systems of liberation are intersectional. We also need to understand that systems of oppression were also intersectional. And so what we're looking at this week is a condensed version of this topic that looks at four distinct moves. The first today is dealing with both the origins of the systemic theological and cultural domination of white supremacy. Then we will move from that into a social ideology of race, and specifically unpacking what in the world is white, and what does this mean, and where does it come from, and how do we wrestle with this? Because some of us have been told we need to wrestle with our whiteness, but we don't know what that means. We get it, but what are you talking about? So what does it look like? What is it constructed of? What are its characteristics? And then from there, we'll then, the latter half of this week, look at systems of resistance. Because what I want you to walk away with is the same thing that my students walked away with, which is the same systems of oppression that were constructed and informed by a reading of Christianity, the systems of liberation and the fight against those oppressive systems were also informed by a reading of Christianity. And so there is hope, there is good news, and the way in which we continue to combat these systems is also by reading our text closely and really reading our text from the margins. That is, elevating the voices of those who've otherwise been excluded in our history. So with that, let me give a disclaimer. These two lectures today and tomorrow are going to be hard. And they're going to be hard for all of us. They're going to be hard for those of you who identify as white, because you're going to hear aspects of your history, of our history, that you've only either never been told or you were lied to about, right? And it's going to be hard for those of us who are embodied as persons of color, because we are the victims in this tale. And I'm standing here as an embodied black man having to tell a group of white persons about our collective history. And so that's going to be hard for all of us. And today and tomorrow is going to be hard, but I promise you, if you stick with me, Thursday and Friday make a turn for hope. And I get really excited about the resistance movements that we'll talk about, because the incredible ingenuity it takes to fight against these systems. And these are all of our ancestors who fought in really constructive ways to be able to do this. So with that, we're going to be on a journey together. So we're going to be looking today at what historically was theology, but now we call a white theological frame, which informs most of Protestant Christianity. We'll look at what is known as a normative practice of Christianity, which again was conveyed as white Christianity. And then we'll look at the formation, all of those things conspiring to form what we now know as America. I'm going to tell you now There is way too much material for the time we have allotted. I'm not worried about getting through the slideshow, so feel free to jump in with questions as you need. There's a spot after we talk about the middle passage where we're going to pause, because that's an intense moment, and that's a space for us to just breathe, but feel free to ask questions throughout. I will say this, no question is too sensitive, but I will assume grace until proven otherwise. Amen. So that means feel free to ask a question. I will not take offense until I'm proven otherwise. All right, so let's start with a quote. This is a 1960 Meet the Press interview with Dr. Martin Luther King. Can you see? Okay. I think it's one of the tragedies of our nation, one of the shameful tragedies, that 11 o'clock on Sunday morning is one of the most segregated hours, if not the most segregated hour, in Christian America. I definitely think that the Christian church should be integrated, and any church that stands against integration and that has a segregated body is standing against the spirit and the teachings of Jesus Christ, and it fails to be a true witness. This was said 50 years ago. Absolutely relevant still today. Most of our congregations are still homogenous in that they're white or black. Very few. There are very few successful models of genuine integration. And what I mean by that is there isn't a dominant culture at work in the worship, right? So when you see integrated communities, worshiping communities, they're typically a group of diverse people, but they're worshiping in a white Western style, right? There are very few examples of congregations that actually embody from week to week the cultures from which they come from and the worship from which they have, which means we do not do this well. And so King's words are still very much relevant to this day. King points to a reality that actually is the consequence of historical traditions that date back 3 and 4 centuries prior. And so the origins of the divisions of race in Christian practice start way before Meet the Press interview. And if you remember, some of you may remember the climate of this country in the 1960s, in which who was being blamed for identifying these inequalities? Black people were, right? People of color were being blamed for, it was always this way, this is how it's normally being, you're causing all the trouble, right? That's still happening today, is it not? It's the same complaint against Black Lives Matter and other protest movements. If you would just be quiet, this is what we, right? But the reality is we're naming truths that otherwise had not ever been, that had been suppressed before. So let's look at this. Now I'm gonna get technical, so if you need me to slow down, this is a good time to ask questions. And I'll try to put together a resource list by the end of the week, so, because I'll be naming a lot of different texts that will be useful for your reading. Yale professor Willie James Jennings wrote a wonderful book in 2010 called The Christian Imagination, Theology and the Origins of Race. And in it, he talks about the problem of the white European imagination, specifically during the colonial period. And that is, Jennings says that when Europeans got on their boats and began to encounter people on continents and in places that did not look like them, instead of encountering them on their terms, on the indigenous population's terms, and understanding who they are, which was an option, they imagined those individuals within their own social construct, right? So one of the examples that Jennings talks about is Jesuits going to Japan. And in reading the historical narrative of the Jesuits who were in Japan, the description of the Japanese people are, first and foremost, they are white like us, right? And because they are white like us, they are like us. They are organized. They have a system of sophistication. They have a culture, a refined, right? And so then they can only identify the Japanese as being like them. Conversely, when, as Jennings goes on to say, when Henry the Navigator first brings back Africans as a gift to the Roman Catholic Church. Henry the Navigator's historian writes that these are Negroids because he struggles to find a word to describe them. And then from that term, defines them in opposition to their whiteness, right? And Jennings goes on to say, in that moment, black is born. The concept of blackness is born in that moment. And that is in the late 1400s, early 1500s. And so what Jennings calls all of this, he calls it that the colonial imagination is a diseased social imagination. It's capable of imagining and dreaming, but it's deeply flawed. The other thing that Jennings says is that prior to colonialism, humanity, we are collectively people of our land. So wherever you are, your gods are there, your community is there, your ancestry is there. Whether you're a European, whether you are on the North American continent, whether you're in the African continent, you are people of the land. What a diseased social imagination does is take people out of their land and put them into groupings, false groupings. So, for example, in West Africa, you have Yoruba, you have Mandingo, you have Bassa, you have all of these different tribes and groupings that are of the land. But then colonial empires comes and says, all of this difference is summed up in one word, black. And wherever the diseased social imagination comes, on whatever continent it arrives, it destroys the conceptions of people and their relationship to their land. In some cases, taking them away from their land. Right? So Jennings goes on to say that very early on, the Christian concept, Christianity, and this diseased social imagination become bedfellows. Because in the colonial period, everything you did was a religious function or with the blessing of the Catholic Church. And so the actions of, and we all know this, you'll hear more from Rachel this afternoon about the doctrine of discovery, but the so-called age of discovery and the militant Christianity that's born out of that period is inextricably tied to Christian theology. And this is part of our collective lamenting for those of us who come from white Protestant traditions. This is our collective heritage. And this is what we have to struggle with. Any culture that is not European becomes subject to this diseased theological and social imagination. And so you get an us versus them mentality. Us, European, white, and them, everybody else, right? And the most extreme of those being black and then gradations there, which gets developed over the centuries. But there are some ways in which the colonial powers, in order to say there's a us versus them, they have to work to say, well, who are the us? Or to use good West African verbiage, who be the us's in this, right? So you first have, in the first part of the colonial period, 1450s till 1517, you have, we're all one big family, we're the mother church, so we're all the church. Of course, after the Reformation, you have Catholics and Protestants, but we're still white, and we're still European. We'll fight amongst ourselves, but our fights are ours. It's almost like no one gets to talk about my family because these are our internal battles, but at least we're not as bad as the Moors or as the Jews, right? Vis-a-vis Martin Luther, right? The North Africans or the West Africans or the indigenous populations of what would become the Americas, right? So we become Christian versus everybody else, and the everybody else includes the quote-unquote savages, right? The villains, who in many cases become the objects of our gospel mission, right? So why do we go to America? Why do we go on these colonial conquests, we tell ourselves to civilize and Christianize the savage. Right? That's what the writers say at the time. The other thing that happens during this period, the colonial period, is the birth of the nation state, right? So we start moving to political borders, which then involves religious negotiation, right? But you know what really causes this problem is not internal to Europe, but it's when the Portuguese and the Dutch start arguing over African colonies, right? Or the Spanish and the Portuguese start arguing over American colonies, territories that were already belonged to people, but they weren't really people. That's part of what this is about. So again, I'm moving through quickly. The point here is that 15th century colonialism foments a practice of the Christian faith that justifies military and imperialistic forces that would dominate our history from the 16th century to the present day. Now, it doesn't start there. If you want to spend time in church history, it actually starts with Constantine and the marrying up of imperial forces with Christianity. You can read all about that, Constantinian Christianity, and the ways in which the Holy Roman Empire becomes conveyed. That sort of affirms political power, military power, with the Christian faith, so that the cross ceases to be a symbol of liberation and now becomes a symbol of conquest. All right. So that happened long before this period. By the colonial period, though, you get hey, it's all right to do this. We've been doing it all this time, and now we get to do it to other people. And those people aren't people, right? So we get the birth of what I call Christendom, colonial Christendom. Our churches, our present-day communities are outposts of Christendom. That's a hard lesson to learn, is that your local church, in one way or another, is an outpost of Christendom. By the simple fact that if you've never interrogated your own history, you're an outpost by default of Christendom. If your church looks fundamentally different from the neighborhood in which it lives and exists, you might be an outpost of Christendom. And if you're struggling with how do we make these connections, you first must deal with this history and understand how deep your complicity with Christendom is. Let me stop. That's like 800 years of Western civilization in 7 minutes. So, yes.
You were talking about the us versus them mentality as a kind of like an us Christendom versus them savages.
Yeah.
Did this apply to the Orthodox Church in the East as well, or was there not as much of a us versus
so weirdly, it depended on the branch. So Ethiopian Orthodox, no, because it was contained in Ethiopia. But in the Coptic Church, there was some of that. But remember, the Eastern Orthodox splits were political. Right, so, well, you may not know, I said remember, but you may not know. So the Orthodox split happens because of theological issues, but it results in a political distinction, which is why you get a Holy Roman Empire and an Eastern Empire. And so the way in which they actually cozy up to the political powers is different. It still happens, but it's different. But there isn't this strong sort of colonial instinct that happens in those ways. It does happen, but in smaller local ways. In the West, the sanctioning of the Holy Roman Emperor in conquest and using the church to do so becomes so normative by the time you get to the 15th century, why would we ever think there's any other way to do this? Okay. Yes?
Don't we have to go back even further to the texts that lead to this? I mean, going back to Abraham, don't we have a problem there with Abraham being given Canaan?
Yeah, we do.
And already populated. I mean, it seems like that goes to the very root of the way we way we have to struggle with our Bible stories.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you bring up a very good point. Though it's missing there, I mean, so we get the idea of conquest and religious formation of conquest, but what's missing is the concept of race.
Yeah.
You get the concept of ethnicity.
Yeah.
When you talk about Samaritans and the splits in the Hebrew Bible. I mean, the whole book of Joshua is just,
so you,
right?
Identifying feature of race or this concept.
Right. Well, but it's there, right? So, but the concept as a theological construct is not, right? That's the big difference. So as Christians, we should collectively have a problem with the book of Joshua for its inherent racism and its conquest mentality, and the fact that it's even in the Bible, right? So all of those things are all problematic, but it's been given to us. I'm not advocating removing it from the Bible. I actually believe that it's given to us to wrestle with our own sort of proclivities of, but if it's there, but we don't interrogate it, we don't look at it, right? But you're exactly right. Our penchant for religious nationalism, if you will, and religious conquest is clearly present there, and we just aren't interrogating. And what I want to say to us collectively is that's sort of how we are outposts of Christendom. We just don't interrogate. It's the benign sort of, I just didn't know. But the reality is you're a disciple. And you are the carriers of your current, of this generation's expression of the Christian faith. You cannot now leave Holden and say, I didn't know. Right? And you should be disturbed by that. And that's the whole point. That's the whole point. But yes, you're exactly right. So quickly, colonialism. I'm using a very particular definition, which comes from a sociologist and an anthropologist. Oh, I'm sorry. Where are you? Yes.
So does that whole idea of like Constantinian kind of like conquest Christianity, does that begin with the Crusades, or does that begin with the Holy Roman Empire or
World? Before both. So the Constantinian Christianity happens in 321. We get a whole creed out of this doggone thing. The Nicene Creed is in part coming out of that. And and Constantine is sort of the first Holy Roman Emperor. And so you get a Crusades because you have a Constantine. Right? You get all of the things that flow through the Middle Ages and the conquest of the Middle East, the so-called Middle East, and everything that flows therefrom. Starts with a some would argue a flailing emperor who needs an identity to pull the whole empire together, and the commonality across the empire is Christianity. It's present everywhere, so he's a political genius. He says, "I'm a Christian." Look, right? He has this revelation. The legend says that he has this revelation on the night before the battle of the Millennium Bridge, and you'll conquer by this sign, and he sees a cross, and so then he organizes his generals to paint crosses on all the banners and everything else, and of course, guess what happens? They win the battle, and everybody converts to Christianity, except Constantine, who doesn't convert to Christianity until his deathbed. So he's a political genius in that regard. But he gives birth to the marrying of military power, political power, and the Christian identity. Which, one way to understand the current expression of the Catholic Church is simply the last vestige of the Holy Roman Empire. It's one way to look at it. Anybody else? So, in social science literature, colonialism is a form of domination which is the control by individuals, groups over the territory and or behavior of other individual groups. It's a kind of domination of whole groups requires a great deal of systemic and philosophical, theological infrastructure. So this is not just a political thing. This is an entire societal view. And the most refined example of this is British colonialism. But there are many examples of this. Throughout. And there are military, political, and religious elements to this, but all of them are conspiring to build an identity. And really, whether it was the Dutch or the Spanish or the Portuguese or the British or the French, all of them were employing an us versus them mentality in their way, right? And so another way to describe colonialism is the petty feudal fights of continental Europe now taken to a global scale, right? So the entire world is embroiled in the controversy between the French and the English. What in the world does North America have to do with the fight between the centuries-old fight between the French and the English? Nothing other than it's more territory and we get to fight over each other. And who are the people or the bodies that are victims of this? The indigenous populations who are already here, right? And so this colonialism in this way is an entire enterprise of European society, which results in, by the 19th century, the divvying up of the entire continent. So this is a map of the height of European colonialism in just one continent, right? So how many countries do we have there? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 7 countries dominate one of the largest land masses on the planet through military and religious power. Now, I could not, it was a web link, but I could not pull down the map of the tribal expressions. And it was just the tribal expressions was just of this part of the continent, of which there were nearly 8,000 different dialects and languages, and about 300 to 400 different tribal distinctive cultures in one geographic region of the continent. If you zoom that out, Africa was estimated to have almost 15 to 20,000 different kinds of cultural distinctive as a continent, right? So who in the world do these 7 countries think they are? Right. That they would dominate all of
them. Can you just say a rough year that would have been the case?
So this is from the 1880s. So that by the 1880s, this is the cultural makeup of this. The best example I give is Belgium, which is smaller. It's about the size of Rhode Island, maybe a little bit bigger than Rhode Island, right? It has one of the largest land, right? King Leopold's Ghost, right? It's a great text, read it, that talks about that King Leopold's entire future and selling of his own monarchy is predicated on this colony, right? Which is now mostly the Democratic Republic of Congo. Right? The reason why the resources and the political states of most of the African continent are the way they are, not because of the internecine fights of native Africans. It's because of this crap. Right? The dysfunction of pulling out of some countries as late as the 1970s and 80s. Right? And while this says that Liberia is independent and Ethiopia is independent, that's not exactly accurate. So Liberia is founded by Americans, African Americans, repatriated African Americans, which was fueled by an organization called the American Colonization Society, which was made up of good Methodists, good Presbyterians, and including the head of which was a woman by the name of Harriet Beecher Stowe. The goal of which was to figure out what are we going to do with these black people. They should be free, but that doesn't mean we want them here. So, by an act of Congress, the American Colonization Society is formed, one of the few religious, private, public partnerships in American history, to figure out how to get, how to find land for these Africans who really don't belong in America, and were stolen, so we run out. So, Liberia's story is a fascinating one in that they have a similar foundation narrative as ours. The capital of Liberia is Monrovia, named for the President James Monroe. But here's what happens in colonialism. The colonized individuals, the freed African slaves, the enslaved persons who are now free, are put on boats from places like Portsmouth, Virginia, Baltimore, Maryland, New York City, and they sail across on the Elizabeth, which is the equivalent of their Mayflower. And there, you know what those freed folks who were once enslaved, who are now free, you know what they do when they arrive and see the indigenous people there? They enslave them. So here you have black people who once were enslaved, now enslaving other black people because they know no other way to be. They create the theological, the philosophical, and the social constructs of oppression there. And the indigenous populations call them black white people. Right? Because they dressed like white people. And there was always a white person who was kind of keeping tabs on those new folks. Right. Ethiopia is continually attempted to be invaded by the Italians over and over and over again. They never succeed, but I would say of all of these, Ethiopia is probably the closest to an independent as it can possibly be described. I say all that to say that this map is not formed without fights against religious ethno-nationalism. So, you know, we're Dutch, and this is what we believe, and we're going to stake our claim here. We're French, and being French means this, right? And recall the hurt of European empires post-1940s, when they have to let go of their colonial powers, right? They lose their identity, right? Churchill essentially loses his prime ministership after World War II, and when he comes back and rallies back on? Keeping the colonies! The remaining African colonies, that was the whole point, right? So he sends a young Elizabeth out to do a world tour to the colonies to keep them in the family. Something called the British Commonwealth, which is the remnant of the colonial, right? All this stuff is still present today in some form, and we're just not interrogating it. We lied to ourselves and said, we're doing all this because we need Christianity on the continent, or we need Christianity on, no. As some of the Southern African tribal leaders would say, they never trusted the church because they knew that once the Bible came, then came the gun. So the reason why the priest was killed when they first arrived to start the mission school was because we got to cut this head off before it starts getting in here, right? And so this was the way in which you had resistance happening. You lied to us, and so now we don't trust you. I'm going to not talk about the doctrine of discovery because I think Rachel's going to do a wonderful job with that this afternoon. Mm-hmm. So, but I will say that all of this is imbued and tied up in the doctrine of discovery that doesn't just victimize Africa, but the Americas as well, and Asia. And so this is a global phenomenon, as I said. Remember, the sun never set on the British Empire. And that was a point of pride. Lastly, I'm going to delve into imperial economics here. And so we're going to talk about the Middle Passage. So again, this is an intense part. How many folks are familiar with the Middle Passage? Right. We'll talk about the Middle Passage and something specifically called the Ma'afa. How many folks know the Ma'afa? So, the Middle Passage is the story of the transportation of black Africans as commodities, as objects of trade, to the Americas. So, what is understood as the Middle Passage is this leg of the trip. So European ships would first go to Africa, which was the first passage, and then they would kidnap, bribe, conspire with other local tribes to take indigenous populations, men, women, and children, load them onto ships, and then from west the coast of West Africa, take the second leg, which was the Middle Passage, across to the Americas. Most of the ships went to South America. Most of them. The Americas only, North America only got a fraction of the persons that South America had. And then they would bring their slaves, sell their wares, and in exchange for those slaves, bring sugar, rum, coffee, tobacco, and the last slaves back to that. We do not know how many were kidnapped and stolen. But by rough estimates of just the slave logs, the ship logs, upwards of anywhere from 12 to 20 million people from the 1570s to the 1850s were kidnapped from Africa to the Americas. Most historians agree that the Middle Passage and the Ma'afa in particular were defined the single greatest disruption of humanity caused by humanity in human history. The impacts of which are still felt today. The Ma'afa speaks specifically of the happenings of that took place on the Middle Passage.
How long? How many days?
Could be as little as 6 weeks or as long as 12, depending on the weather. Many ships sunk. The person, so I'll get into the, let me go to, oh no, let me do it now. Wait a minute, where is it? I'm going to jump around for a second, so give me a second. I'll come back to some of that stuff. So this is the diagram of a slave ship, a typical slave ship. You would have a ship that was really designed to carry barrels of rum, tobacco, what have you, to be reconfigured with decks that were no higher than 24 inches and 24 to 36 inches, and human cargo would be loaded into the belly of the ship, and you were to lay down and be chained to the deck. Women were on one side of the ship or one part of the ship. Boys, children were on another. And they would be, prior to that, they would have been marched from the interior of the continent into slave castles, many of which still exist on the coast of West Africa. And there they may have been held for a few weeks or a few months. They would be fed, they would be trained. Sometimes they would be given language and skills, rudimentary language skills. And then at some point they would be transported from the coast to the ship, and where they would be marched into the deck of the ship. Sometimes as many as 200 or 300 persons on a ship with less than 6 inches of room to move in any one direction. You couldn't turn over, right? You couldn't move around. You may have gotten sunlight once a day so that the muscle wouldn't have atrophy. All of this was, in the minds of slave, of the captains, was about commodity. And so you work excuse the expression, the beasts, so that you had a maximum return on your investment. They were not compliant. They fought back. In some cases, they would jump over. And because they were chained, they would take a whole row with them to the bottom. They were raped, beaten. In some cases, to prove a point, a slave captain would pick somebody out of the midst and shoot them to show them what would happen. There is the telling of an African prince who was kidnapped at a young age, Oluwadu Equiano, who, when he won his freedom, wrote his narrative, and is to this day singularly the greatest first-person telling of what took place on the Middle Passage. And it was he and his sister who were both kidnapped. And so we're told about what happened in America, and that slaves would do all sorts of things in America, but we never are told how they got here. This enterprise, and I need to back up, that experience was known as the Ma'afa, the terrible happening. And there are writings from the African side who said they, you know, in some cases, some tribes participated in selling people. Because throughout human history, a conquered people may have to, you know, serve their conquerors. That was normal throughout all human history. But chattel slavery, which was a commodification of human bodies, was foreign to many of the indigenous populations in West Africa. So, oh, these white people are coming and they want slaves, okay, and we get paid for them, sure, no problem. We don't know what's gonna happen to them. But it is not until much later that we discover writings in which folks begin to say, had we known. But, you know, hindsight is always the better. So here's some of the building blocks that get us to chattel slavery, really quickly.
Question. What was the impact of like 15, 20 million people being West Africa? What impact did that have on West Africa?
We don't know. And in some respects, we may not ever know. We do know that whole generations of tribes were wiped out in some instances. And we know that because other tribes talk about no longer, you know, coming to whole villages and nobody being there. So we'll never know the true impact of that many people. But here's the thing, this is a long period of time, hundreds of thousands a year, each year. The height of the slave trade really was the 18th century, mid-18th century through the early 19th century, where that system was refined, right? What began to change things are, you know, I don't know, a whole revolution in Haiti. The tenacity and the resistance of people like Equiano to tell their story and to highlight the humanity of what's going on here. But we don't know. We don't. Yeah.
Before the Europeans came, did the tribes enslave each other?
Yes.
Okay, so it was a history of slavery in Africa?
Yep.
Because my family is Northern European, Norwegian, and the Vikings enslaved
Europeans
and sold them in Baghdad.
Yes. Yeah, that's what I say. It's a normal practice. What makes a difference is what I'm going to talk about here.
Okay.
Right? What happens in colonialism is a twofold process. One is a linking up of the religious identity or the theology of humanity, right? Which, particularly in the papal bulls, Dum Diversus, which says Muslims and all non-Christians are damned to perpetual slavery. Right? Notice when that happens, 1450s, right? As we're beginning to start up. Romanus Pontifex, 2 years later, expands the definition of authority of European Catholic powers so that it becomes anybody that's not a Catholic, right? So we encounter people on our travels. You're clearly not Catholic. Again, disease, social imagination. You're not Catholic, you're worthy of slavery, right? But that's not just Muslims or Africans. It's Muslims, Jews, very, very broad category. What changes? What changes is that there is value in seeing these black bodies as a perpetual source of wealth. European political powers then petitioned the Pope to say, can we, are these bodies human? Are they of God? Are they a part of, and the answer is, well, no. That's the default answer. So, and the same happens with indigenous peoples in the Americas. Are these people? Are they human beings? They have the same, right? Are they, right? We see this later on in America. We'll talk about this tomorrow, that the first laws that sort of make chattel slavery in America happen in Virginia. And the Virginia legislature, as early as the 1620s, debates whether or not African enslaved persons are worthy of baptism. Because the theological understanding is, if you are baptized, you are in Christ. And if you are in Christ, you are free. So should we be baptizing these folks? You know what they do? They split the hair. Yes, you can baptize them, but they're not people in the sense that they can be free. They're free in Christ, but not free here. And that's where we start seeing sort of a distinction between a spirituality that now isn't conveyed in evangelicalism, a radical piety versus a lived reality, right? The Virginia legislature says, baptize them all you want, but don't teach them to read. And the only persons that really love them is Christ. But they'll figure that out when they're dead. But they're not human beings for the purposes of, right? We go through efforts to split this hair. The work of that begins as early as this point. So, here's a quick timeline. 1415, the Portuguese occupy islands off the North African coast. From there, they bring back some captured Africans as servants, five of whom, I think it's 15 total, but five of whom are given to the Roman Catholic bishop in Lisbon as an offering, and they are immediately put into the service of the monastery there. Pope Nicholas issues Dom Diversus that talks about perpetual slavery, the first construction of people can be enslaved for the rest of their life, or that there's a set group of people who are set and built by God for slavery. I think that's the language that's there. 1454 expands that definition to anybody that's not Catholic, that is not of the church, right? Now, of course, all this gets blown out the window just a few years later with Martin Luther and what he says. Spain and Portugal negotiate a treaty that separates the Americas, but also any lands that are found, right? So we sometimes have been taught that the division of Portuguese and Spanish in South America happens in the 16th century. It actually starts in the 15th century when the Portuguese and the Spanish are already competing over Africa, and they go to the Pope to negotiate it, and the Pope says, listen, y'all got, this is a division. Whatever lands you find, if whoever gets there first, this is what it is, and you'll learn to live together, right? So it's that sort of premise, but then they discover a whole new land someplace else. '1502, first enslaved Africans are brought from Hispaniola to Europe. Sorry, it's typo. And then 1525, first enslaved Africans were transported to America directly from Africa. So there's a bit of the Middle Passage runs opposite for a little while. So it starts in Africa, they go to Europe, and then they try to get there. And it's, why do we need to, that's a middleman, we don't need to do that. So let's just go straight from Europe to Africa to the Americas. Right? 1619, they first, right? So we've been focusing on this date, right? All this time. Look at all this other stuff that happened that led to 1619. It's a blip on the radar. Right? All of this other stuff was happening before we even got to Jamestown. That was supposed to be a clip from a History Channel video, but it was a play, something like that. Here's what I want us to take away from at least this understanding of the Middle Passage. It is the Middle Passage and the Ma'afa that create, together with the Dutch East India Company, the British East India Company, all of those models of global transportation start with the Middle Passage. The Middle Passage becomes the first global industrial complex. And what is it using? Human bodies. To fuel sugar, tobacco, rum, rice. That industry gives rise to the what becomes the American colonialism. So without the Middle Passage, there is no America. Yes?
Was there an active thought process for not taking slaves back into the home country imperialism? Or was it just the engine to pull the resources from
the colonies?
The colonies into it? Was there? I would think that there might also be slaves.
They didn't live. They wouldn't live long. European continent. Think about the climate of England, and they did not live long, and so the climates were temperate. West Africa, Hispaniola, South America. The climates were temperate. Southern America. Climates were temperate. And the bigger piece there was there's a colonial business engine happening here. We're growing cotton and things that we cannot grow back in Europe. It's a process of learning that takes place in the late 15th century, early 16th century, which they hone and refine. Once they get it, by the 1570s, 1580s, then we don't need to bring this stuff back to Europe. We do it all here. And we use our military power, we use our political power to reinforce our assets here. And what about the people who are already in those colonies? Well, they didn't work as well. So what do? We killed them or moved them out of the way and then brought people in to work the land. Again, diseased social imagination. Removing people from their lands and dominating. Another great book, Stand Your Ground, Kelly Brown Douglas, published in 2015, helps us to understand Christendom and how it informs the American context. And what she says is, British colonialism is probably the height and pinnacle of this system, right? Of both the capitalistic system, the cultural import. The British had a method. You sent the Anglican priests. After the priests, you sent the redcoats. After you sent the redcoats, you established colonial governance. After you sent the colonial governance, you then dominated the land by organizing the people by their proximity to whiteness. So, at the top of any colonial structure, I don't care if it's India. I'll pick on India for a second. If it's India, the redcoats arrive, you're there. You already have a built-in caste system that is thousands of years old. What do the British do? They insert themselves to the top. So now Brahmins, who are the priestly class at the top, are now, they're just under because of their proximity to whiteness. And what do the British colonial folks do? They say, they're even light-skinned like us. So they are white. And then those who are on the bottom are the darker Shudras and even the Dalits, who are out of the caste altogether. We can just simply enslave them. In Kenya, and what was Rhodesia, later to become Rwanda, right? Those places become in Southern Africa, what they do is describe and take black Africans and say, oh, you're taller like us. So you are like us in this way. In Rwanda, the colonial powers use the divides that were long-standing generational between the Hutus and the Tutsis, and says because one group looks, has Francophone noses, looks like us, they're the white folks. And so they're like the white folks. So we're at the top, then you're underneath, and then the others are beneath, which upsets the generational balance that was always there. And so now we wonder why there's a genocide in the 1990s. And the Europeans say, huh, what happened? What do you mean? This is horrific. This is why our history, the way we teach history in this country is so problematic, because what we say is history is past, and it's not. History is a lived, ongoing experience, and everything that we are experiencing now stems from a reality that we can trace. And so the British master this idea by elevating white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. I'm sure you've heard of that at one point or another. WASP, white, right? And you can add male, right? To use 21st century language, heteronormative, cisgendered, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant.
Thank you.
Yeah, with the whole thing out there, right? And America, because my nation argues, is the bastion place and the pinnacle for white Anglo-Saxonism, right? It's the place where they don't have to worry about the French or the Spanish, right? Think about who's that, pick a founding father, right? White Anglo-Saxon Protestant. What she argues is, we are a tribal bastion. What is the tribe? White Anglo-Saxonism. That's the normative. Everything else is a subsidiary of that. So, Christendom and this tribalism becomes the foundation of American democracy. All men are created equal. Insert in parenthetically, white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant. Close parentheses, men are created equal. Yes?
Quick question. Do you have any thoughts on why we didn't just white colonials from European colonials didn't just enslave the indigenous people here in North America? Why did they go to the trouble of going to Africa?
Well, they tried to. They tried to enslave indigenous populations here. But if you read the notes on the State of Virginia and a few other folks, Thomas Jefferson, notes of the State of Virginia, tells you why. He says, they are too unruly. And they know the land better than us. Right? So you send them off to do something, they don't come back, and you can't find them. I mean, you know? And what you'll discover, and this is why I love the hope side of this later in the week, because we're going to be talking about that ingenuity. Right? So Thomas Jefferson, in the notes on the State of Virginia, says in print, they are not good for this. And then he says, but the African is. Because the African doesn't know the territory. The African is lost and disoriented. The African has his culture taken away from him. So without the drum, which is the heartbeat of the indigenous peoples, all over the world, the drum, right? Africans were not allowed to make drums or bring drums or pots or anything to bang on. And when I was in public school, I used to say, you know, the white teachers when I taught public school would blame the kids for beating on their desks. And I would say to them, but it's in their DNA. Instead of saying don't beat on your desk, give them a drum to beat on, right? But you took the drum away, you took their language, you mixed up their languages, right? On that slave ship, it wasn't all one tribe, it was multiple tribes. So I couldn't talk to you. We both cried, but we could not understand each other, right? And so when we arrived, we did not have a common anything except our blackness. And the beauty of the resistance is that that was all we needed. And that was, in many instances, more than enough, that we found ways to communicate both with our African brothers and sisters and the native indigenous populations who we ran to for safety because they knew the land, who taught us the vegetables, who taught us the flora and the fauna, who helped us to understand how to cultivate the land so that we might survive in the face of this. Other thoughts, questions? I want to quickly move to the foreshadowing of the resistance before we end. I told you it was intense. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry.
So why did this happen so much in, like Western Africa, but not really anywhere else? I mean, I know it probably did happen in other places, but why did it happen so much more in Western Africa?
In terms of people being taken from Western Africa?
Yeah.
Because of access. It was relatively easy. There were tribes that lived all along. There were rivers that flowed well. When you start to make the turn onto the southern coast, you got a lot of desert. You got jungle that goes right up to the edge of the water, and so you may not run into people. And frankly, the Europeans were quite scared of penetrating the jungle, particularly in Central Africa. You know, when you read some of the you read Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, which is it's a novel, but it's based in part on the storytellings of folks. There was mean folk in the interior. And so, you didn't survive well, even with your masters. That's part of the reason why the Belgian conquest of the Congo was in part tearing up the jungle, destroying the land, so that you could then organize it in the way that you wanted, right? So it's really a matter of access. It was easy. You could time well from Europe to West Africa, and then from West Africa coast, the trade winds were in your favor. Remember, you saw that middle passage route is the same way our hurricanes come, right? So there's a natural wind flowing 9 months out of the year off the West African coast across to the Caribbean. So it's easy. Good question. Others? Yes?
How much do you see this as a function of capitalism? I see white diplomacy culture, I see lots of this bound up in that need to acquire, and I'm wondering how you frame that or how you see it.
This is the birth of capitalism. You get trading markets for what? Cotton, sugar, tobacco, and bodies, right? Our global markets are born in this way. So the heart of, this is another reality that we have to struggle with. The heart of capitalism is racist, right? And it is born in a system of oppression, right? The basic economic model, 3-5% in a unemployment in a capitalist model. That's a healthy economy. Well, who are the 3-5%? Not white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. Men. All right. Others? Question? No? Okay, sorry. Resistance. I'm going to save this for tomorrow. So, I already said that. Okay. Okay, so American Christendom is embodied in these ways. We'll talk a little bit about these in more detail tomorrow. But slavery, obviously, this concept of manifest destiny, right? That we white men, white families, are to conquer the whole of the continent, and nothing can stand in our way, which is not unique to the United States of America, but unique to all the colonial powers everywhere, to dominate the whole land. And domination means subjugation of any people, subjugation and eradication of any peoples who stood in the way of this. And the heart of manifest destiny is a theological concept, not a political one. God has ordained it to be so for us to inhabit all of this land. God gave this to us, right? And we see manifest destiny still manifested to this day. When we hear people say things like, well, my generations of family worked hard on this land, and it's our land. We did it. Somebody lived there before you did. I promise you. right? So just because you came, you ran some folk off, right? But this is about, you know, how we, the Homestead Act, for example, right? All of those are active ways in which the U.S. government did this and linked up to theological precepts to do it. Our tribalism that takes place. Yes?
I wanted to ask this question before you go too far into the next topic. Because I heard you say this earlier. Where do you think the idea that, like, our ancestors were, like, complicit with what white Europeans were doing? Because you said, like, I think you said, like, oh, these people weren't resisting what the white man was doing. Where do you think the idea that, like, oh, we were just, like, just going on the boat, we're just going...
Yeah. Reading Equiano, it gives you real insight to the mindset. There's a real trauma that happens. And so Equiano doesn't use his language, but you can read his language as PTSD, total shock. Right? He's kidnapped in the night. His entire village is destroyed. The elders are killed. He's actually away the day before, and so then he comes back home, he celebrates, there's sleep, it's been a great time, and then in the middle of the night there's an attack. He says, by morning we're in the jungle marching at the head of chains around us. And so from that point on, the language that he's talking, the way in which he talks, just sounds like shock. So in some cases, they don't resist because they're just utterly traumatized by what happens. He also talks about hearing other people talk about, we'll only be here for a little while and then we'll go someplace else, right? But we don't know what someplace else is. Are we going back home? Are we, right? He says he has to tell his sister, who's younger than he, that everything's going to be fine. We're going to a better place. What are you going? What else are you going to tell? You don't know, right? And then there are those who fight back and resist. So there's a lot of factors, and I think this is where we when we read those narratives, we have to really struggle with their humanity, right? Part of what we do with historical figures is we try to contextualize them in a certain kind of way, but they are also sort of complex individuals just like us. So some are traumatized, some are wounded, some are complicit, right? In some cases, folks turned in tribes and then turned around and were sold themselves, right? And so it's a complex issue, but I think it's all of those factors that lead into that. And I think we have to be careful sort of thinking, oh, if they just fought back, then whatever. No, they did. A lot of people did. Yeah. Yeah?
Can you talk about, you know, how what a bad nightmare it was from the Apaches and then arrived to the Carolinas, and they fought because it looked similar?
Yes.
And they fought over your home, but in retrospect, in a foreign country, the Americans.
That's right, that's right. So many, there are a lot more slave narratives. The narrative of Henry Bibb, for example, Harriet Jacobs, for example, who talk about, and these are all books you can, they're still in publishing, still in print, talk about the auction block. So coming off of the ship, now being in a foreign place with foreign people, you are so disoriented because one person is Yoruba, another person is Mandingo, y'all don't speak the same language, all these, right? So you're all black folks, but you're all traumatized if you survived, right? Some of the worst trips were 3 out of 5 persons on the ship died, right? There was one ship that left Africa with 180 souls, I think, and arrived in Charleston with 24. Right? So you've seen all this death, all this horror. You arrive and you are naked. You are fed gruel, which is essentially, you know, watered down cornmeal. And you are then put on a block where people poke you and touch you and feel your muscles and your genitalia and your legs, and you know, if you fight back, you're whipped. And then they bit on you. And all of this isn't happening in the language that you don't know. And then all of a sudden someone takes you. Well, in the case of Equiano, he is there with his sister. And of course, they're separated, right? He never sees her again. And so this happened over and over again every single day. I was in Charleston in May, and we visited the Slave Mart, which is now a museum, which was the holding pen for the ships that came. Charleston was the largest importer, the primary port of entry for most of the American slaves that were internal to the country. Charleston imported more persons than any other city in America. And the Slave Mart was the busiest place. You know what the busiest day for the Slave Mart was?
Sunday
after church. Right? Even though, you know, Sabbath rules were supposed to apply, you're not supposed to conduct business on Sunday, right? And they had some of the old posters up. $1,000 for a 19-year-old, well endowed, meaning muscular, $1,000 in 19th century money. $1,000, right? And you had acres, you had land, rice plantations that were, in some cases, 500, 600, 700 with enslaved persons numbering north of 200 and 300 people, right? And you had governors and leaders who would send their overseers to buy 6 slaves, bring them back, and you'd have to train them. You know, they don't understand English, you give them a Christian name, and in some cases the first thing the plantation would do was baptize them. Right. And have pride in the fact that all of their slaves were baptized. Right. All of this happening as a machine, over and over again, in all 13 colonies, and then the lower colonies. But let me be clear, the economics of the North was predicated on the industriousness of the South. So who do you think built the ships that transported American cotton to Europe? Shipyards in Connecticut. In Rhode Island, in Massachusetts. Who built the barrels that supplied, that carried sugar and tobacco? Places like Baltimore, Philadelphia, right? So the American economy, capitalistic model, right? What made us an economic engine? Slavery. Right? So all of this happens, leads to the Civil War. Here are the ways, just some of the ways in which we resist. I'm almost out of time. So, abolitionism. There are two kinds of abolitionism. We'll talk about this a little bit. There is general abolitionism, which is good, well-meaning white folks who don't like slavery, but don't necessarily like black people either, but don't like the idea of slavery, who fight against slavery as a legal concept, right? And then you have black abolitionists. So abolitionism generally is not is anti-slavery, but not necessarily anti-black racism. So a prominent figure of that would be Harriet Beecher Stowe, for example, who would abhorred slavery, abhorred it as a Christian woman, or kind of Christian woman. but on moral grounds, she abhorred slavery, but she was also a rather significant racist, thought that black people were not really going to be able to thrive in. Read Uncle Tom's Cabin and you see the caricature of all of the black people, which is her interpretation of all the black people she met. She does encounter Frederick Douglass, as far as I'm aware, and that's an interesting exchange that Frederick Douglass writes about later. So every abolitionist wasn't pro-black, right? Which then creates a deep suspicion amongst black folks at the time about who's really for black people, right? And that's when you get Frederick Douglass and others, David Walker and a few others, who are actually black abolitionists. Because black abolitionists say, no, slavery is evil, and black people are human beings, worthy of equal status. And during that same period, there are very, very few white people who would believe that, including Abraham Lincoln. Right? So that would be in a normal construct. Black people are not of equal standing. This is why Frederick Douglass is such an important figure not the only, but one of the more important figures, because he actually embodies the full humanity and is able to debate and go toe-to-toe with anybody to say that black people are fully human in the same way. The work of Native and Indigenous peoples in terms of their ways of resisting informs particularly African Americans' ways of resisting in terms of the subversive and finding ways to fight back using skills, tools, and other ways of resisting white supremacy. And we'll talk a little bit about that on Thursday, Friday. The ongoing debate that happens throughout the 19th century about slavery, as well as black people participating in that in all sorts of ways. People like Harriet Tubman, who give impassioned speeches in the homes of folks. Harriet Tubman is also important to intersect with indigenous populations as well. Because remember, she's going back and forth through the, who teaches her? And then the struggle for equity in the Reconstruction period, which we'll talk about a little more. Let me get a little more, I've talked about some of these already. I do want to mention that the Ma'afa results in the single largest group of forced diaspora human beings in history. Today, upwards of 200 million people have African ancestry in North, South America, and in the Caribbean, who are not, that genome is not otherwise present, natural to the native to that community, because they trace their descendants. And the greatest integration and the mixing takes place with indigenous populations in South America, Central America, the Caribbean, and in North America, which is something we don't talk about, right? That the majority of Brazilians are black, the majority of Cubans are black, Dominicans, black, Bolivians, black, in all these places, right? If you were to just look at American politics and look at South Florida and think Miami and Cubans in Miami represent Cuba, that is not the case at all. Most Cubans are black and trace their heritage to the African continent. The origins of Santeria and Voodoo are West African cultural traditions that are syncretized with Roman Catholicism and Native indigenous practices of those communities, right? All of these things are happening. Told you I had a lot. So, resistance. Well, we'll talk about specifically, tomorrow we'll talk about sort of construct of whiteness, but I want to name that throughout everything we've discussed, there are ongoing movements of resistance. So, there's an ongoing fight from the outset for the values of Christendom. That, you know, actually Jesus didn't say the things that you say he said. Or when he said it, he didn't mean what you say. You know, this experience of Jesus and all of his teachings about doing your neighbor, right? So over and over again, Christendom has to change its theological position. So it says, oh, well, these people next to us are worthy of slavery. Well, neighbor, do unto others as you have to. Okay, well, they don't count because they're not really our neighbor. Well, what about the Samaritan story? Well, you know, actually, we are the good Samaritan and the savage is the one in the ditch, right? So we are helping them, and the way we help them is by giving them a place to live and resources, and in turn, they have to work. So over and over again, Christendom is pushing, and there's a fight against Christendom. There's also the constant fight of dignity, humanity. We are full persons, right? So against this, when you say, all men are created equal. Well, I was told when I was in school, well, men meant everybody. Right? So when you see man, just think everybody. And I would often be chastised for saying, but men and everybody aren't the same thing. Like, one is inclusive of the other, but one is exclusive of the other. Right? And the teacher would say, well, no, it's just the way it is. Well, actually it's not. It's not the same, right? So self-worth and dignity means that we have to include everybody in this process. And then, more specifically to the American context, if America is going to be America, then the resistance movement says, well, this is what America really means. If it's equality for all, then all means all, right? And so for what I love about some of our forebearers who were enslaved is that they understood liberty is not a legal concept, but an actual theological concept. So that even, you know, the African-American slave person could say that even though I'm in chains, I'm still free. Because my freedom is not predicated on a white man's determination of my legal status. I can be free, and that confounded, you know, certainly abolitionists who didn't really, you know, how do you struggle with it? No, I'm free because I'm a full person. I'll tell you a quick anecdote from history. Henry Bibb, who was an enslaved person in the 19th century, who ran away over a dozen times before he finally was successful, said he never was much for church because he couldn't take the slave preacher, the one who was always indoctrinated. But he said one time when he ran away, he hadn't eaten and he was starving. He had nothing to eat, and he happened upon a chicken. And he said, in that moment, he became a religious person. And he said, I'm going to eat this chicken. And he said, I heard the slave preacher say, thou shalt not steal. And so he said, well, this got to be somebody's chicken. I can't eat it because I would be stealing it. And then he says he heard God say to him, how can one be guilty of stealing when you've been stolen? Yeah. He said, so I had chicken that night. Right? So liberty and these legal constructions have no bounds on the bodies of our ancestors who fought against the system. Justice is not a court issue, it's a faith issue. And you see this over and over again embodied in Martin Luther King's theology, that justice is a faith issue and people of faith should be concerned about justice. And so the indictment is, if people of faith are constantly reinforcing injustice, are they really people of faith? And then equality is a theological commitment, not just a great social concept, but it's a theological commitment, meaning that God requires all of us to be, we're all God's children, and so we all have a level playing field there. Like I said, today was intense. It's a lot. Breathe. Questions, thoughts, comments, reflections. We have just a little bit of time left. I have some questions here, but we don't have to go to those questions. We'll go back to breathe. There, breathe. Yes.
So, as an old lady here, I struggle. I don't know how to resist. And I look at resistance in my own community, and I think it is worthless. And I'm in my brain, I'm going like, I need to do better. Standing in a corner looks nice to everybody coming by, but it's just not, we're not doing, I want to work on the system and not the other. It's always the system that we have to change before we can get any. I don't know how, I need some guidance on what's effective resistance that we can really change. Is it getting involved in systems, or what do you think?
So we'll talk about this more. I'll give a preview of this now. First, a good friend of mine who's dean at a Methodist school, Methodist Theological School of Ohio, says it this way. She says, the demon is big enough that everybody needs to fight the demon in their corner. So fighting the system and the incidences, because we need both. So that's first. So don't think, oh, I need to fight this when there's something right in front of you. Right? You know, what's in front of you, deal with that, because that may actually take you down to a systemic piece there. Second is something that I would recommend to everybody. It's a book by another good friend of mine, Willis Johnson. It's titled Holding Up Your Corner. And it's a great little text. It also has a workbook to it. It's good for your church or other community to actually read collectively, Holding Up Your Corner. And what he talks about there is driving cross country to stand in some protest and really, you know, sick it to the government about, yeah, that's one way to do it, but that's not really how you topple the system. Holding up what's going on in your particular community and facing the injustices that are right down the street are more effective at dealing with the injustices from a systemic perspective. So how, what are the things that are right in front of you? And then how might you then organize to address those issues? So those are big, those are two big 30,000 foot level pieces. This week we'll be looking at ways of resisting historically that will help us to understand this. One way we're going to talk about it really intimately, and what I love, is the way in which African-American enslaved persons read the gospel in the face of white preachers and heard the gospel when the white preachers wanted obedience, right? So it was understood that if you were preaching at a plantation as a white man, your job was to preach, slaves obey your masters. That was a sermon over and over again every Sunday. But at night, enslaved persons would gather in the cabins and they'd hear how Moses told Pharaoh to let my people go, right? And they heard that Jesus loves the little children, all the little children of the world, right? They heard all of these other narratives, suffer the child to come unto me, right? Those who are free indeed. All those were heard, and they couldn't read, but they knew it. And they use that as a model of resistance. I call that subversive, a subversive reading, right? And when you, you know, I'm not meaning to offend anybody when I say this, but when you're part of the, when you by default are part of the system, by your birth and your heritage, you don't think subversively. It takes effort to think subversively. But if you are always on the downtrodden side, subversive is what keeps you alive, right? Stealing a chicken and having what theologians and ethicists would call deontological ethics, which says right and wrong is relevant to the moment that I'm in, and doggone it, I'm hungry, and this chicken is here, it's right, right? You know, that is a construct that you develop from a subversive perspective that you do not have. And so there are voices that we will hear from the margins that will help us to think through how we might organize for ourselves. Yes?
Didn't Southern plantation owners issue redacted or censored Bibles that cut out the bits?
The most famous of whom was Thomas Jefferson. He wrote his own Bible, including rewriting the Gospels of Matthew. There is a copy of it at Monticello, and there's a copy of it in the Smithsonian. He did a whole bunch. He redacted a whole bunch. But Jefferson at one point owned almost 800 slaves. So, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure how to formulate this, but it seems like, you know, there were a lot of people born in slavery in the country, so it was once people were brought here, it was kind of a people being born into slavery. I would wonder if you could comment on, you know, how that really has been perpetuated in terms of oppression through Reconstruction and Jim Crow and redlining and the Great Migration and everything. So that's still part of the issue, isn't it? That people are excluding born into
systemic oppression.
Yeah. I mean, it started during slavery.
So tomorrow we will talk about that very issue, the way in which whiteness is protected through these systems, right? America outlaws slavery very early. You know, we start the conversation in the 1820s and by the 1840s, you know, the importation of slaves is outlawed, right? Now, technically, the last slaves are really, the last Barracoon, which is a recently published book by Zora Neale Hurston, wrote it, It has sat in a vault since the 1930s, mm-hmm. but it was just published a few years ago. And she, in the 1930s, interviews the last person who's imported as a slave, mm-hmm. which was in the 1870s, I'm sorry. Right, so Civil War's over, but he comes to New Orleans as a slave. And he was, you know, an enslaved person coming, and supposedly in New Orleans, ends up marooning someplace in Alabama. And he's alive in the 1920s, and she interviews him as a part of an effort to document some past place. I say, I would say that America is unique in the United States is unique amongst the Americas in that it created its own internal market, right? And so then slaveholders were encouraged to create more of their own commodity that they could then sell internally amongst themselves. And after, that was really the case after 1802, when 1804, when the Haitian Revolution happens, and the white owners say the main reason why the Haitian Revolution happens is because there's a constant influx of new folks from Africa. And having been to Haiti and heard Haitians tell their own history, one of the things that was the rallying cry for the Maroons in the mountains was, if you fight in this battle and die, you will return back to Africa. And for most of them, the memory of Africa was still fresh. And so, and the other big piece was almost a 10-to-1 ratio of Africans to white owners there that become dominant.
Are we
going to
talk about the connection with prisons and slavery? Because I know when slavery was abolished, it was in the Constitution that slavery is illegal except as a form of punishment.
Right, except as a form of punishment, right, 13th Amendment. So we'll talk a bit about that in the context of things like redlining and Jim Crow, that slavery technically existed through the 1960s in this country as a form of punishment, right? And so what you had in the 1890s, 1900s, all the way up until the 1940s were black laws like it was illegal for a black man to stand in court. You could be arrested for loitering without intention or business, and so then the sheriff would arrest you. Even though you were just waiting for somebody to pick you up, you'd be arrested, taken to the courthouse, and you would be charged a ridiculous bail. So $100. And so you don't have $100. And so then there'd be a nice gentleman who's a farm owner who'd also be in the court and say, you don't have $100. You can work for me and pay it off. So, but every night you had to go, well, it was worse than sharecropping because every night, guess where you had to go back to? You were on bail. You had to go back to jail. But every morning, you go to work. It'd take you years to work it off. In other cases, the sheriff himself would go round up a bunch of black people from the community, charge them with flagrant kind of made up crimes. They all go into prison. The magistrate would set judgment that would either be $100 or 5 years hard labor. And then what the sheriff would do would subcontract out the hard labor to Joe Blow the farmer. So now Joe Blow the farmer gets free labor. He doesn't pay anything. The sheriff gets paid. Magistrate gets paid. The people aren't enslaved. All legal under the 13th Amendment. Yes?
But then you look at the way that the so-called war on drugs affected different communities and how it feeds into the prison industrial complex, and we can argue that slavery still exists.
Right. Well, and it does. I mean, the 13th Amendment still says slavery is illegal, outlawed, except as a form of punishment. It's still on the books. Right? So if you drive in certain parts of the South, you still see men at work on the side of the road cleaning. License plates in certain states are still made by prisoners with on cents on the dollar pay, right? So we're paying them, right? So all legal on 13th Amendment. So, yeah.
During the height of the slave trade, did the Americans ever go to Africa to get the slaves, or was it always shipped from Europe?
Americans never do anything except make war. all that we do is make war ourselves.
So the whole time was just
subcontractor. Yeah. I mean, you had American slave ship owners and ship companies doing this. In that, there's a prominent family who still whose descendants are still alive in Rhode Island, who made their fortune on building the ships. But they were clear that they never sailed them. They just built them. So, you know, Americans subcontracted everything out, right? You'd run a contract, and the contract would be very lucrative, right? A ship captain would be hard on his luck. Maybe he lost a shipment of tobacco in a storm or something like that, and he was in debt, and he needed to do it. He'd convert his ship to do slaves and take a contract and go be slaves. And with that one contract, he would pay all his debts and do more. Right? So it's a business. The business model is formed in the Middle Passage. It is lunchtime.